Recorder on. It is, just for date and time purposes, Sunday, January 9th, 9 o'clock in the morning, doing continuing politics of exclusion in Judaism. And we're continuing with the Rambam. You'll notice that even though it looks like I've been handing out the exact same source sheets every single week, even though we've only been doing like one block, one source a day, I threw in an additional source here. We've been going through Rambam's Hilchot Teshuvah, his laws of repentance, but for today I included something that he wrote in his commentary to Pirkei Avot. You'll see why. It'll be fairly obvious when we get to it. The difference in, you know, Pirkei Avot and Mishnah Torah, he wrote the commentary to Pirkei Avot when he was much younger. The Mishnah Torah is primarily halacha, was written for the masses. I mean, his commentary to Pirkei Avot, you could say, was also written for the masses, but the intent was very different. And we'll see why it's really important to do this one and why I'm including it in the section where we're mostly talking about Mishnah Torah, because it'll help explain where the Rambam is coming from. Or at least, you know, it gives a little bit of the background of what he's trying to say in the halacha we're going to study today. Up until now, we've been doing a lot of theological issues or cultural issues, such that if someone gets up and does something, the way that, you know, one theme that we've been trying to explain it as is you are removing yourself from the Jewish community. Like if you get up and you say declaratively, "I don't believe in God," you're, you know, it's not that we're actively throwing you out, but you're making a statement. Exactly, you're pushing yourself off to the side. And last week we dealt with two different types of rebels. Of like, one is through your actions, you intentionally, you know, say it's not that you, you know, like eating not kosher. It's just, you know, you intentionally eat not kosher and making a point of it, or a vote as zara, which has a certain degree of severity, that you basically sell out, you know, Judaism to worship a vote as zara, not because you believe in it, but because it's just more convenient. Today, we actually are going to see an example of where the politics really come in. And, you know, which, I mean, there was a reason why I called it the politics of exclusion, because on one hand you have halachot, you know, laws about, you know, what can or can't say, certain things that might make intuitive sense. Sometimes these things can be used, or, that's a bad way of phrasing it, the terms can evolve and the applications can evolve depending on the scenarios and the situations that you're faced. We made a comment a couple of, almost over a month ago, that you're going to find people who are going to be more vociferous against people they consider to be biggest competition, or certain things that, or decrying, if not a specific group, certain things that they do that you may see other people picking up on, even if they wouldn't be associated with it. You can say, well, you know, this group of people was a negative archetype, therefore other people who are following in this negative archetype, we can compare them to that other group, and just as that other group, you know, we consider outside the pale, so too this group that's following in their footsteps is outside the pale. And how you can apply it, that's where you can really get into the political side of things here. Not to say that that's what's motivating Rambam, but what I want people to start to have in the back of the heads for today is when we go through the source and the description of Rambam, to think, how could his descriptions be applicable today? We're going to get through it, you know, and eventually in a couple of months we go to the modern period. Try to think a few generations ahead, or as modern as possible, where you find an analogous group of people or an analogous ideology, you know, that you could say, oh, you know, these people are like so-and-so, these people are like, well, so-and-so, plus for a second. Get things started. And could you read us Rambam's Hilchot Teshuvah 3:10, what we have in our source sheets here, source number 5A.
How does one cause the masses to sin?
Right. Machtia Tarabin Ketzad, one of the many things that Rambam, we're in source 5A on page 2. Rambam Hilchot Teshuvah 3:10, one of the types of people that Rambam said loses their share in the world to come is Machtia Tarabim, if you cause other people to sin. Go for it.
With something big such as Yerovam and Sadak and Baitis, or one who causes other to sin with something minor, even though not doing a positive commandment. And who compels others until they sin, like Menashe, who killed Jews until they worshipped idolatry, or that he caused others to err and push them to worship other gods.
Yeah.
keep going?
Well, no, let's stop here for a second.
I don't even know what I read.
Okay, so the question is, what does it mean to cause other people to sin? Right? And we have a couple of different examples here. One is major, big time causing people to sin, like Yerovam. Anyone know, want to talk about Yerovam? Anyone recognize the name?
Yeah. They're talking about the Civil War now. Remember the Civil War?
Mm.
He led the Civil War, the secession of the Northern Kingdom.
Yeah. And at the time of generation after King Solomon, Yerovam started what we would call the Northern Kingdom of Israel. Among other things, kind of like set up his own temple up there and like forbade people from coming down. That's pretty big. Tzadok Invitus, we've heard before, which is why I included 5b to explain that about Tzadok Invitus. We'll spend a little bit more time about, you know, some of these other aspects here before we get into Tzadok Invitus. Right, there is, even if you get someone not to do a positive commandment, you're considered Machti Tzarabim. It can be done coercively, like say Menashe, who's considered of the, you know, bad kings of Israel, would be one of the worst. Or getting other people to worship idolatry, which we can understand is, you know, fairly bad. On this point of, you know, getting other people to sin, there was an apocryphal story going around yeshiva when I was in Gush. So this was around 95-96, about another yeshiva that had who could do the biggest Easter contest. Oh. You know, who could do this? Again, it's one of those stories which is probably not true, so I won't even mention the name of the yeshiva to which this was attributed. But there was a discussion of what was really bad. So as, the way that the story was told to me is that the guy who came in second had relations with his girlfriend and Yom Kippur, and the winner was the guy who poured milk into a cholent pot. Because that, you're machtia tarabim, you cause other people to sin, and that, according to Rambam, you lose Olam Haba. Fine. Point is, you know, when you cause other people to sin, right, sometimes it's actually doing something like that intentionally. You can think about an example today of people, you know, are carrying, you know, because there's an Eruv, and some guy like 2 seconds before Shabbos shoots it down to say, ha ha ha, you're all Mechal of Shabbos. I mean, yes, the people who were sinning might not have known they were sinning, you know, but, and you might want to put that, you might even categorize that under something, you know, a little bit different, because here, you're actually causing people to sin intentionally, like really leading them astray, as opposed to, you know, lipnei iver lo titein mifshol, putting a stumbling block before the blind, whether or not you want to make that distinction. But, you know, in a kind of broader sense, you might say you're still causing other people to do something they're not supposed to do. They might be really ticked off about it afterwards. Minimally, it's an iser of lifnei iver lo titein mifshol. At worst, you're machtia tarabim. But you can see certainly, you know, where today this can come up in any position of Jewish leadership. Because if you've got any rabbi that tells you this is X, Y, and Z is okay when it's not, right? Or someone says don't do the X, Y, or Z, even though they should, you know, you can run into similar issues.
What do you think about restaurants advertising their kosher style? A lot of people don't know the difference.
So Rav Tendler had an issue with that in terms of false advertising. He also gave stories that of restaurants that put up signs that said basar basar, because the bet looks very similar to a chav. So to someone who's not that discerning or has bad eyesight, it reads basar kasher.
Oh man.
Right? But if you say, oh, you're misleading, saying, no, we're just saying that there's meat here in Hebrew. You know, and it gets into like the whole kosher laws there. So, you know, one thing that I picked up was apparently you're not allowed to say a place isn't kosher if they say they are. Depending on the medium, you could be held, it's either libel or slander. I keep getting them confused which one is print and which one is spoken.
That actually happened on Grand Street using.
Not surprised. So, like, I know if you call up certain kosher agencies and you ask about a certain symbol, the smart ones aren't going to tell you it's not kosher. They'll tell you it's not recommended. Because if you say it's not kosher, you can say, well, what do you mean? Like, you know, we're kosher, we say we're kosher. And the only way that you can get around that is to actually, like, argue your case in the court and trying to cite your idea. Like, you know, actually hear the laws of kosher, which is a huge separation of church and state issue. Aside from the fact you don't want a civil court judge trying to paskin what's kosher and what's not kosher.
What about something like, our rabbi doesn't hold by their hash?
So that is a declarative factual statement. So if I can say, I personally am not, like, there are ways that you're supposed to say that, ways not supposed to say that, you know. And that's up to the rabbi to be a little bit discerning, to say, I don't think this is consistent with Jewish law for X, Y, and Z reasons. And then you can say, well, my rabbi doesn't hold with it, which is also a true statement, and then people can do what they want. I'm not a lawyer. No one should rely on me, you know, for the legal stuff. If you try this stuff and get sued, don't blame me. Just be, if you want to be strict, be on the careful side and, you know, be a little evasive. But you're right. If I'm Jewish and I'm, you know, actively misleading people, you know, and lying about it, you could very easily call that under the could call in the category of mafti etzer rabim, or again, minimally lifnei iver lo titein mechshol, and at worst mafti etzer rabim.
They could have made up a hypothetical example, but the real examples that he chose are so extreme that it's the king of a nation, or, you know, it sounds like the leader of a nation, that some guy shooting down an Eruv or falsely advertising kosher meat, that's small potatoes.
Well, right. Well, that's why he said, like, even something minor, you know, So he gives them a negative extreme on one side, then he gives, you know, a minor side, like, even if someone's preventing you from doing a positive commandment. With Tzadok and Baitus, and why I include 5b here, which is from his commentary to Mishnah, and what we're going to go to now, we may be able to view this not only as just extreme, you know, these were people who deviated, but they deviated in a certain pattern, which you could see other people doing the exact same thing even in his time, right? And all of this is going to be fleshed out a little bit more. When we did the Gemara section on Siddukim and Baitusim, we found that we didn't really have a clear story about either one. We knew that they were a group of people who lived at least in the time of the second Beit HaMikdash. They did a few things differently, at least that Chazal weren't fans of. They argued with Chazal, and they said, you know, Rabbi Akiva said explicitly, you know, don't give them ammunition to yell at you. You know, remember all that stuff. We had even less about Baitus. The actual person Baitus, you know, had his tana that he used to follow halach and said, oh, I'm relying on this rabbi. Rambam here, though, gives us, this is Rambam tearing his commentary to Avot on 1:3. He gives us a little bit more of a narrative that at least I found no basis for in the Gemara. Where he got this from, I'm not entirely sure, but it's important to study this because it helps show when Rambam uses the idiom of Tzaduk and Baitus, and this is the second time it came up in Hilchot Shuv alone, to know at least what does this mean for Rambam. When he uses the term Tzaduk and Baitus, what does this mean for him? All right, so we'll think of it in those terms. Right? Dan, you want to start with number 5b?
Do not be as servants who work for their master on condition.
Right, that's in brackets because it's the commentary on which, you know, it's writing on commentary. That's the piece of Pirkei Avot that Rambam is commenting on. You know, don't work for the don't work on the condition to receive reward. Rather, work as if, you know, a worker who's not doing it on condition to receive the reward. He spends a paragraph explaining exactly what that means. So we're coming to it in the middle of a paragraph on that discussion.
And there were these two students of Antigonus from Silchot, one named Tzadok and the other Baitus, and when they heard this teaching, they leapt from him, and one said to the other, behold, Master has taught explicitly that there is no reward and no punishment, and that there is no hope at all. For they did not understand the Master's intent. I.e., he did not say that there was no reward, rather, one should not worship God with the expectation that he will be rewarded accordingly for doing so.
Right, so you see the logical distinction, right? There's a very big difference to say, don't worship God expecting a reward, and there is no reward. So in Rambam's explanation, these two people, Tzadok and Baitus, were contemporaries. They were both students of Antigonos Ishsofo who made the statement, and they both came out with the same conclusion from Shir. Not the first time people came out of a Shir with the wrong impression, right? So, but they said, ah, there's no reward, what's the point of doing all this? So go on.
And they joined together and separated from the Torah. And they formed two groups which the sages called Sadducim, Sadducees, and Baitusim. And it was that they were not able to gather groups of people based on what came to them as a matter of faith, For this type of evil faith separated those who came to them and certainly would not bring those distant closer to them. And so they followed the proofs which would not disappoint the masses. And whoever would go out from their words, they would be killed.
So just to explain, before we get to the detailed discussion, to explain what he's talking about here, their first attempt was, well, this whole thing doesn't matter, so we're going to split off from our teacher and we're going to start our own thing. The problem is, if you're going to start a religion, say, based on cynicism and there is no reward, you're not going to attract too many followers, right? So, you know, if you're going to, you know, so all right, so it didn't work out so well. So then, according to Rambam, they said, well, that's not working, so they started doing things that would have been more popular, that people would be more amenable to listening to, that would be a lot more attractive to masses. Because let's face it, if I'm going to go up and, you know, I guess how to put this, unless you were, you know, certain sects of Christianity in the Middle Ages, you know, preaching fire and brimstone 24/7, you know, isn't, you know, going to be a turn-on for a whole lot of people. At least it wasn't in that day. It was in other periods of, you know, Western civilization. But for the most part, like, if I'm going to set up something like that today about how everyone, you're all going to hell, you know, I might get a couple of people, but it's not going to go off that well because people don't want to hear that on a regular basis, or at least whatever message you have. You know, if it's not something people are going to like, then you're not going to be fairly successful. So continue.
That is, I mean to say, one, the text of the Torah, two, and they presented themselves as a group who believed in the text of Torah, three, and they disputed the rabbinic tradition that it is an incorrect tradition.
Right. So when they went off and started their own thing, they didn't just say this entire thing is a scam. According to him, you know, there's a certain, you know, pragmatism involved here. Thoughts like, well, what can we do better? So instead of just throwing it all out, we'll keep the text of the Torah. We'll still believe in it, but, or, you know, say that, oh yeah, the Torah is the Torah, but we're going to reject the, say, rabbinic interpretation.
This stands somewhere between the conservative and the reform movement.
So we'll talk about that a little bit later. Kudos for thinking about how it would apply later. We'll get back to that, how something like that would apply. Let's finish the Rambam, though, because he really fleshes out this idea.
And was so that they would remove them from themselves all the accepted laws, decrees, and enactments, since they could not get rid of everything. For example, what was written and already accepted.
Right. So people are already accepting the Torah as a given, and you want to start your own thing, you're going to have to work with them in their own context. So you're not saying the whole Torah is worthless. I say, oh, I agree with you up until this point, but we can do something a little bit differently. Yeah.
And they expanded into the realm of interpretation. Thus, as they returned to interpreting as they chose, they were lenient as they wished and strict as they wished, according to their agenda. Since they did not believe in the essence in its entirety, and only wanted to promote that to promote what would be satisfying to a small group of people, and from small numbers these accursed groups grew groups of heretics, as they are called in this land. I mean to say, Egyptians call them Karaites, and their name by the sages And these are the ones who began to throw faults at the tradition and to explain the verses according to what would be acceptable for people without listening to the sages at all. Regarding this, it was said, by ways of this Torah, and do not deviate.
So, summarize here, his explanation is, you've got these two groups of people who left their teacher, started their own religious sphere, didn't go so well, and then they decided, you know what would be better if we keep parts of the Torah, but we'll reject the rabbinic establishment, we'll come up with our own interpretations, and we'll do so, you know, we'll be strict, we'll be lenient, we'll have our own interpretations, reject what Rambam calls the Kabbalah, not the mystical tradition, but the tradition, and we're just going to go off and do our own thing, not necessarily based on what is correct or what's a better reading, but purely based on what is expedient. Before we have a discussion here, I want to throw in another important Rambam, because if you could read this and say that their big sin was that they were arguing with the sages on how to read the Torah. Right, it's possible, you know, to read. It's like, well, there, you know, what's the real difference? Rabbis read it one way, you read it another way. So two things to recognize is, one, It wasn't just that they reinterpreted Torah, but first off, they got rid of all gezeirot and takanot. Anything that was a pure rabbinic enactment, get away with. In terms of interpretation, I want to include here Rambam Hilchot Mamrim, Laws of Rebellion, which we actually did here, Chapter 2, Halacha 1. Beit Din HaGadol Sher Darashu Ba'achat Min Hamidot Kifi Mashin Yer'ebe Enehem Shadin Kach V'dino Din. If there was a Beit Din HaGadol, so let's assume you have a Sanhedrin that reads the Torah a certain way, and to them they understand this is what this verse means, la halacha. Right? They're reading, doing what we call midrash halacha. They're reading a verse and saying this is what practical law is going to be. The amad achareihem beit din acher, and another court came up afterwards. V'nir'eh lo ta'am acher listor oto hadin, and another court sees that there's a reason to undo the law that was previously made. Hareza soter v'dan kifi mashi yir'eh be'enav. They have a right and they have the halachic authority to undo to undo the law as they see fit. Shne'emar el kol hashofet asher yebayamim ahim, that you listen to the judge that you have in that day. Ein atachayav lalechet ela achar beitin shebedarecha. You only have an obligation to listen to the courts in your generations.
This is only assuming it's a Sanhedrin overturning an older Sanhedrin, right?
Yes. Whereas he makes a distinction in the next halacha that if you're talking about overturning a gzeirah or takana, a rabbinic enactment, then you need a beit din gadol b'chokhman gadol b'minyan. You need the court that's literally bigger and better, greater in number and greater in wisdom. The difference here is, one, according to Rambam, it's shedarashu ba'otot min hamidot. There is a certain tradition of exegesis, legal exegesis, that you have, that you expect people to follow. There's certain rules of discourse in terms of how do you parse a text. When the Supreme Court has its debates over the Constitution, I really like this analogy of, you know, us being, you know, think of it as a constitutional monarchy with the Gemara being the Constitution that's interpreted by the Supreme Court. There are laws to how you can interpret the Constitution of the United States of America. In an age of, you know, postmodern intellectualism, you could read any text through any other lens. Like, if I read the Constitution as, say, an allegory for Scientology, in theory, you know, I could, if you give me enough time, people will just, you know, substitute it. You know, people do stuff like that for shtick every now and again, even if it fits or not, but that's not the legal discourse. You've got a tradition of how legal discourse is supposed to work. You've got different schools of legal discourse, etc., etc. I'm not going to get into, you know, originalism and all that, but you can kind of see the analogy. The issue that Rambam seems to have here with Tzaddik and Vaitus isn't that they reinterpret, that they had a different interpretation, but they intentionally got rid of the entire rabbinic tradition. That's one issue. Another issue is that, why were they doing this? It wasn't because they thought this was objectively right. According to Rambam's explanation, or his description, is that they were doing so for political religious expediency so that they can put themselves in charge and have a bunch of followers. This is exactly what you complain about that the rabbis do so much, is that, you know, they're trying to set this up, that, you know, rabbis just want to, you know, people to follow them. According to Rambam's spin here, this is what exactly the Tzedukim and Baituzim did. And I say spin because, you know, tracing it back to the Gemara, we don't have evidence that this is what happened. But it could very well be, in Rambam's time, this is, you know, either, you know, more information came out, like, for whatever reason it wasn't recorded, or it could be Rambam saw this as a legitimate problem in his day. Like, when you have sectarians, right, who start up their own organizations and their own denominations, it's one thing to say that there's a legitimate ideological split. You could also look at it incredibly cynical, in that, why are you starting your own organization? Because your previous organization didn't give you enough kavod. Think about this in the nonprofit world, right? You have people who get into an administrative fight, say, well, I don't like the way you run things. I want to start my own nonprofit, and I'm going to be the guy in charge. I'm going to be the executive director. And it's not too much of a stretch to make analogies today to see people who go off and start their own thing, be it a shul, be it, you know, another subgroup of any larger denomination, if you want to step out and make a name for yourself to have a bunch of followers. So first off, any thoughts on Rambam? Then we can talk about, you know, what would be some ways that this could have been, you know, on Dana's point about how this could have been adapted to rhetoric in the modern time. Any thoughts on this, first off, people have? Like, again, I can pause if anyone doesn't want their stuff recorded. Just give me a signal.
I think one thing right away is, what we've been talking about, is motive.
Mm-hmm.
You see, cause, you know, it's hard to read anybody's mind, so you can only see what actions they do.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of this is talking about, well, like we're talking about here, they were doing certain things not probably because they believed they were right or wrong. It was just to get a group to follow them.
Mm-hmm.
And the motive there might just be totally wrong from the beginning.
Yeah, and it's kind of, I mean, you raise a great point there. Like, there's no way to really know in detail what someone's intentions are. Yeah.
Well, wasn't the whole basis of Reform and Conservative something on the order of halacha should adapt to people rather than people changing their behavior?
The origins of conservative Judaism are a lot more murky than, say, the origins of Reform. My understanding of history was that there was no... It wasn't really that conservative Judaism broke off from anyone. Rather, this is, again, my understanding of the history, based in part on the Tradition Renewed series, like these two massive volumes written on the history of JTS and also Sarna's American Judaism and a bunch of other stuff that I did researching, was that before you had a bunch of immigrants, you actually had American Judaism. And you had immigrants from Europe, some were hardcore Reform, and then you had what we would call hardcore Orthodox. And you had the indigenous Jewish population that didn't make the same distinction between, or wasn't forced to choose between, you know, joining the secular world or being religious. They kind of, you know, did their own thing somewhere in the middle, and the Reform rejected them for being too close to tradition. I mean, the Reform group from Europe and the what we would call the Orthodox group from Europe rejected them for not being part of their tradition. So it wasn't so much that they decided to form their own group as much, and actually there were some statements from Solomon Schachter that he used the term Orthodox to define what they were doing, but it was more of, well, we're doing this to basically address the needs of the indigenous, I mean, that's a bad way of putting it, but at least the existing tradition of American Judaism. But they got rejected from the right and rejected from the left, even though I used the wrong hands for that. You know, rejected from the right and rejected from the left, such that they kind of evolved from that. And I editorializing, I think that's one of the reasons why for decades struggle with the question, what is conservative Judaism? They struggled with this, you know, in the 40s and 50s, never really got a straight answer. Struggle with it in the 70s. You know, so it's like what we are, because they never said, well, here's our platform, here's what we stand for. They were kind of, their social definition was forced upon them by everyone else by saying, well, we don't accept you for this reason, we don't accept you for that reason, and then poof, there you are. Again, that's my understanding. I'm sure historians, you know, can debate that, but that's, you know, my sense. So the origins of conservative Judaism are a lot murkier than, say, the origins of Reform.
My take on the Rambam.
Should I pause it if you'd like?
You can leave it go.
Okay.
He seems like a loyalist. He's presupposing that the tradition is correct, which he has no proof for, but that's what he aligns himself with the tradition and attacks Tzaddik and Vaitis because they were deviating from it. Whether the Rambam is correct, I don't know. The Tzaddik and Vaitis, according to his explanation, were obviously wrong because they misunderstood this business about a reward. But
well, it's not just that sort of rejection. There are a lot of people who disagreed with the Rambam, like even in his own time. Whether or not he'd say that they are Machtiyat HaRabim to this level, I don't know. Meaning you could say, like, you know, Rambam writes this whole book of halacha, you know, called the Yad Chazaka. You know, we have it on the shelf there. And people argued with him. People disagreed with him, you know, in his own time. So, you know, you can say there's a very big difference halachically, whereas, you know, two rabbis can get up and give two different halachot. And obviously we disagree. One of us, you can say, is mahti our communities. If I tell you something is mutar, someone else says it's asur, right? Or vice versa. Someone else, something is allowed and I say it's not allowed, then the person who says it's not allowed could think that the guy who's telling you it is allowed is causing other people to sin. But there's a very big difference between, on a holistic level, to say, you're going to be in this category of sectarianism because we disagree on it. Let's give an example of kashrut, right? Good one. You know, I think such and such is kosher. Someone else thinks it's not. So if I say this is permitted, you could say, well, you're making your people sin by telling them to eat something that's kosher that isn't. But if I say I'm basing it on my understanding of Shulchan Aruch, is very different than saying I'm starting my own sect of Judaism. Right? You can still have disagreements while under the same principles. Take the Constitution. You've got big divides on the Supreme Court. You've got, on one hand, different traditions of legal theory, but they're still talking about law. There's no one, to my knowledge, on the Supreme Court who is a total anarchist, who believes we shouldn't have laws at all and this entire thing doesn't matter. To my knowledge. I mean, I don't know, you know, what's going on, you know, behind the scenes, but no one's going to state it. Right? There have to be, you know, certain fundamental principles of discourse, you know, so within the rabbinic tradition, yes. And, you know, again, Rambam will always assume that, you know, we have to follow the rabbinic tradition such that, you know, one of the things that we did last week was, you know, denying the rabbinic tradition. That there's one way of, you know, denying the rabbinic tradition on your own, and there's another to say, well, I'm going to act as if there's no rabbinic tradition, and even objectively, or not objectively, you can say would be worse, is to present a Judaism that's void of the rabbinic tradition. And not only go to the rabbinic tradition, because notice, it wasn't that he's saying get rid of all the sages in terms of, you know, not, and yes, they said get rid of all the laws, get rid of all the enactments, get rid of their interpretations, you know, just follow the Bible literally, you know, like what we call conventionally as Karaites, which, you know, have their own principle, but he's also saying that they did their own interpretations, right? That, you know, they're going to be strict and they're going to be lenient. Which meant that it wasn't even that they objected in like, it's one of those things where you can break off under a certain principle, but wind up doing the exact same thing that the other people did it, but you're just doing it in your way. Right? So, to give an analogy to, you know, Christianity in a way, you've got, on one side, the Catholic Church, who would say things like, don't read the New Testament, just do whatever the Pope or priests tell you to do, and that's whatever it means. Then you would have Protestant groups that says, wait, why should we follow you? Right? We're just going to do whatever the New Testament says and just follow that literally. Of course, once you do that, you realize, well, we're going to have our own problems of interpretation, and then you wind up interpreting it yourself. So, what you might have broken off for saying, well, we don't need an interpretation, we'll just go back to the original source, but then you wind up doing your own interpretation because you have to. And that's kind of what Sadok and Baitis did, which you mentioned about revealing intent. This could very well do it. Like, if your whole issue is that you don't want the rabbis telling you what to do, then why are you setting yourself up in a position to tell other people what to do?
You're replacing the rabbi yourself.
Bingo. And that seems to be what the issue is. It's like, we don't like what you're doing, but we're going to wind up doing the same thing, just we're going to be in charge, which is why I think his issue is here of ascribing, you know, almost Machiavellian motives to Tzadik and Baitis, that it was really out for their own self-interest.
I don't know, I have a lot of thoughts. But
go for it.
One of them is the analogy to American politics.
Mm-hmm.
We have two groups, and each one claims that the other group has hijacked the process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
or Republicans claiming to be, you know, the party of small government, which is a big laugh.
Yeah. Okay.
In practice.
Whatever. But
yeah.
You know, and yet it's legitimate. But each group feels, you know, you're doing it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both legitimate interpretations.
Yeah, they both really believe in
the same. Until they get in power and they wind up doing the same thing.
Well, okay.
You know, like lobbyists. You know, it's like, oh, you know, we're not going to have any lobbyists until you do.
So to me, you know, I could say Tzadok and Baitis were just, well, they were the Democrats or something.
I think that's the whole point of this was, like, you could argue that the Democrats and Republicans, like you just said, each legitimately believe in what they were doing. There's something more sinister about something like this because you're taking a tradition and you're denying it for whatever reason, but then you're really using a lot of that tradition because it's expedient to get people to follow you, but you really may not believe in it.
These folks are more like the Tea Party, aren't they?
Well, they would be like the Tea Party if you would assume that once, let's say, the Tea Party would take over Congress and then they start voting to raise, you know, taxes type thing. Meaning the Tea Party has a certain ideology, and, you know, they would be the ones that would say, look, yeah, Republicans have always stood for, you know, smaller government, and yet, when Republicans are in office, here's what they do. I mean, people forget that, you know, Bush started the whole bailout thing. And if you're really committed to not Republican, assuming Republican and conservatism, I mean, conservatism is an ideology, Republicans are a party. Whereas, and they were basically saying, even though Bush is a Republican, he's not following conservative ideology. If you really believe in free market, the government should not have intervened at all in bailing out any bank. Right, but Bush was the one that started that. And as much as you want to blame Obama for stuff, Bush did that. Thus, even though he was a Republican, violated conservative principles. So what they're saying is, we want to go back to that conservative ideology. What you can say would be more hypocritical is, if you have a Tea Party candidate that does in fact vote to raise taxes and stuff like that, or, you know, get involved in bailouts. That would be the distinction I would make. Now, you brought up the, you know, going back to something you said earlier, because I think, you know, this analogy of going against the tradition is something that contemporary Jews struggle with a great deal in terms of the political side of what's considered the tradition. What it meant for Rambam is very different than what it means for people today. What it meant for Rambam was following Chazal, following the Gemara. Which is why I made in the reference of, it's not that you can't reinterpret the Bible, but reinterpret the Bible lahalacha according to the midot shenidreshet bahen. Whereas if you get up and you start making up your own midrashe halacha and to say, well, because, you know, the Torah says X, Y, or Z, this means we have to do, you know, something that wasn't said before, you know, might have some issues with that one way or the other. But you can see where, you know, people might make that connection to conservative and reform Judaism, in the sense of people would say, well, you're talking a certain form of Judaism, but you're not following, you know, certainly the halachic tradition of, you know, or people would argue you're not following our halachic tradition, and therefore we can dismiss you just like Tzedukim and Baitism, in that you're not so much a denomination that you might consider, you know, or at least depending on how you define, like, denomination versus sect, right? One would be a variant, but you're still under the same umbrella, versus something else entirely. So Sephardi and Ashkenazi Jews, you could say, well, those would be different manifestations. Conservative might be something else altogether. Yeah. How, a few other things, though, but, you know, and there are very big buts here, though, of what would be the traditions and how would one side view it as the other. For conservative Judaism, right, for their part, and I'll talk more about conservative than reform just because, for two reasons. One, I've read more of their stuff than the reform, and two, they actually have gone through, when they write a response, it's not that here's something that we need to do. There's always an attempt to go back to traditional texts, and by traditional texts, I mean texts that you'd find any other, you know, find in any yeshiva. One example that I love giving is one of the most controversial decisions they made was that it is okay to drive to shul on Shabbat. Right? That was a controversial decision that came out. So people can argue, well, you just pulled this out of the blue. Not true. It was based on Tosafot, a medieval commentator you find on the side of the Gemara. Okay, don't want to get into the details of the Tshuvot now, in terms of how they use the halachic method. If anyone wants to, we could do our own class.
Did you say evil commentator?
Medieval. Sorry, Middle Ages.
I thought I heard evil.
It was actually, technically there was a Baalei Tosaf. Technically speaking, the Baalei Tosafot were a group of rabbis and friends in Germany and one up in England and whatnot. So people refer to Tosafot as one individual. They weren't. But they're considered medieval commentators, as traditional as, you know, look, they're printed in the Gemara, so everyone has it. They didn't just pull it up out of the blue. They based it on certain halachic reasoning to come up with a conclusion that other people thought, well, this is just incorrect. Methodologically, were they doing anything different that people didn't do before? Like, no. Like, what they kind of saw was, throughout Jewish response, the history of Jewish responsa, you find rabbis, traditional rabbis, making all sorts of leniencies to adapt to the times in which they lived. You see this with the Ayin Nesek. If anyone is interested, on a general level, I think everyone should read these works, but read the collective writings of Jacob Katz for just some examples about how things worked. One book is The Shabbos Goy, a case study in halachic flexibility, where people were faced with a certain need, and you know, depending on what people were doing this anyway, you know, how do we retroactively justify it versus one being proactive? From their perspective, it wasn't that they were, you know, changing the tradition, they were changing certain practices, but in terms of methodology, they were doing absolutely nothing different that hadn't been done for generations before.
We had that actually here in the synagogue years ago, because a woman came, she had a little baby, and she had a stroller, and you can't use that stroller quite over there.
Right, so I mean, whether or not you can or you can't, you should know that no one's going to, you know, fight about that here, but you know, let's say, you know, using an air, you know, assuming that Manhattan itself is a kosher air, you know, by itself without, you know, whatever else got taken down relying on that. You know, some people might rely on it, some people might not, you know, there's a, but, you know, you could rely on it, let's say, for a halachic reason that might be wrong, you know, but still be within the halachic, you know, framework. Whereas, you know, to counter the, you know, on the Orthodox side, you know, when they would argue against the conservative side, would say, well, you know, because your conclusions go against the way that we've always practiced, you're not following our quote-unquote tradition. And in fact, for certain groups of people, is even if you disagree at all with any particular rabbi, regardless of what they say, for example, if a, you know, not uncommon if a rabbi says something that's contradicting the Gemara, say, well, you're going against the Gemara, and they can say, well, this is our tradition. If you go against our tradition, you're... If I give more specific examples, I get more into trouble here, so you'll have to speak to me afterwards. But the point is, you know, for conservatives, you know, they're not breaking the tradition, or at least back then, they weren't assuming they were breaking the tradition. Whereas the Orthodox is like, what do you mean? Like, you're still, you know, you're doing things that you shouldn't be doing, or they would come up with a different conclusion. And you could argue against the tshuva about driving on the merits. Like, it wasn't a great responsa, but... You know, you could argue it on, you know, to say, well, this is still incorrect without saying, you know, you're chucking everything. Where you could get into a problem are things closer to other forms of interpretation, meaning if the issue is a matter of interpreting, like, say, a verse, and you're interpreting something completely radically different in a way that had never been done before, that just doesn't make, you know, any sort of sense, where you're doing it to, again, If you focus on a tent that you're trying to set up a denomination to make it more appealing to followers, then you could say, well, maybe that's the big problem behind it. In that when, you know, the decision was made to permit Jews to drive to shul on Shabbat, it wasn't that they thought this was a natural reading of the text. And they kind of admitted that in the way that they framed it. They said, this is something that we have to do in order to, you know, keep things going. Now, if you're doing...
Like a practical thing based on certain circumstances.
Yeah. Now, again, depending on your which side of the fence you fall on, I can either categorize that as hora'at sha'ah.
Can I ask you one question with that specific thing?
Okay.
Suppose there was a rural community, and for whatever reason they couldn't establish a synagogue, except it was miles away from where mm-hmm. someone lived. All right? But at the same time, and you made a rule like that, you know... Sometimes maybe a rule could be like kind of don't ask, don't tell, like, or maybe that's a bad excuse, that you really, your rule is if you can walk to a synagogue and not take any kind of vehicle, then you're almost commanded to do that.
You don't even need to make that distinction, meaning if someone drives to shul on Shabbat, you can still hold that it is forbidden, but also not yell at the guy either. Meaning,
well, you can.
There's also something called, you know, mutafshi shogin gingalo mizina. Like, when you give mussar to people and you tell someone not to do something, as a rabbi, you kind of have to pick your battles about what to do and what not to do. And you can, you don't always assume that because you don't criticize that you go along with it. Mm-hmm. But sometimes mutafshi shogin gingalo mizina.
You don't want to make an issue of it.
But you don't want to make an issue. And if you do make an issue, is it going to help? Is the guy going to stop driving a shul? So if the answer is no, like, that's a separate category. Here we're talking about when you actually give a universal dispensation, which is what we're talking about here. So again, depending on what side of the fence you fall on, I can say that, you know, pro-conservative movement for that. I see the Jewish community in America is in trouble. I see, I mean, this the response that came out in 40s or 50s, I'm forgetting the exact year. I think it was in the 40s. But, like, you're talking about a very different world here. And I'm saying that, you know, we're going to lose people. And that was actually the prevailing thought, that over time, this goes back to Weber's idea of secularization, effectively, that as modernity takes over, there's going to be a linear regression of religion. It clearly didn't work out that way, but there was a real thought, and like, we're going to lose people. So you could view it as what we call hora'at sha'ah, an emergency dispensation. We need to permit this now because it's that important to maintain Judaism. Right? That's on the plus side. On the other side, I can say, we're not losing Jews. We're actually completely fine as we are. The only reason why you're trying to be more lenient is to be more accommodating to people so you get more individuals. Meaning, so you want more people to play for your team, right, to sign up by you because you're going to be easier. Peter Berger wrote something like that explicitly in The Sacred Canopy of how he saw religion working. It's an excellent book, if anyone wants to write, The Sacred Canopy by Peter Berger, where in the way he viewed it was from an economic model. If you want to attract people to your religion, you have to be as accommodating as possible, right, because you're competing, you know, and as they say, the marketplace of ideas with other religions or no religions at all. So if you want people to come to your synagogue, you would logically have to be as accommodating as possible to bring in as many people. He admitted in 2001 that that was not the case and that, well, pretty much, oops, that he was wrong. And the explanation, incidentally, was best described by Stark and Fink, I guess they used more of a rational choice theory in an approach to religion, where they said it's not a and they basically argued about strict churches being stronger than the more lenient ones, and they said it wasn't because of the accommodation, but the exact opposite. The more you put in, there was a greater expected value. It's like, why will people pay more money for an identical product that you perceive that by putting in more money, you're getting a better product? So here's like, because they expect you to do more, yes, it might be more expensive, but it's a lot more valuable too, and so they manage to grow. Slight digression in sociology of religion there, but the point is, you know, depending on what side you fall on, you can either say this is necessary without which we can't survive, and on the other side you can say you're just doing this because you're running out of options, you're running out of ideas, and you're not really interested in maintaining Torah, maintaining Judaism, but maintaining synagogue membership. And in that context, you have the same fight with, say, Orthodox, you know, places too. Like, how do you bring people in? You know, is, you know, if you're more lenient in this side, are you more strict on this side? And it goes by, I would say, the stringency side too. Because if you look at Sadek and Rambam's indictment of Tzaddik and Baitus, he says, you know, the problem wasn't, you know, just that they were always lenient, which is a common indictment of conservative and reform. That actually came from conservative themselves. In 1948, in the proceedings of the Rabbinic Assembly, I believe it was Rabbi Epstein complained that the Committee of Jewish Law and Standards said that they had the power to prohibit nothing and permit everything. And they wanted, and one of the things that he set up as to vote is, we should follow the Shulchan Aruch as our baseline halacha, be it strict or lenient, and that got voted down. That was back in 1948. You could say that the indictment on conservative Judaism might have, I mean, it's not that every single response that they had is permissive, but a tendency there. But the truth is here, you know, when Rambam's describing the Tzedukim and Baitim, he says, well, they reinterpreted stuff to be strict when it's, to be lenient when it suited them, but also to be strict when it suited them. Exactly. So it's not uniformly a problem of being strict or being lenient, but as much as, what is your reason for doing so? Is it really to preserve Torah, or is it that you have more followers? And when you're talking about having more followers, is that necessarily a bad thing? Because if you are a little bit more lenient, but they're in shul, then it's like what people used to call heter kiruv, meaning to bring people closer to Judaism, you'll let a lot of things go, you'll let a lot of things slide in how you work. Again, you're not necessarily justifying it, but, you know, you're not going to be in, you'll scale things back a bit. But you can also say, well, we're going to be, you know, we're going to do things a little bit differently to attract a certain certain people who otherwise would never enter a shul.
Isn't there an ingredient missing there?
Mm.
With a Hetzer Kiruv, you're doing it so that you can eventually help bring them to real observance, or full observance.
Eventually, but, you know...
And the conservative movement kind of stops there and says, well...
Well, no, I don't think it stops there. I mean, that, or at least that wasn't the original intent. I mean, it went through a lot of changes, too, over time, you know, but... that you have to speak a little more internally, but, yeah.
If I can... I don't know. I sort of don't want to turn this into a fight, but from the conservative point of view, I mean, if you view it as an abstract historical problem, when are you part of Judaism and when are you not?
Mm-hmm.
I think the conservatives might say something like, "Look, something happened around the year 800,
mm-hmm.
and the clock kind of got frozen."
Mm-hmm.
Judaism used to be an evolving organism
mm-hmm.
where things change, you get mutations, sometimes they take, sometimes they don't take, and it keeps adapting itself,
mm-hmm.
and something happened around that time where we all became exiled and fragmented, and we're trying to revive that, so we feel we're the heir.
I would even say the, you know, it froze later than 800 because you know, go through medievals, and again, you've got, and the whole, Wiesenschaft, you know, the academic study of Judaism, you know, really helped go through that. Like, how did, going back to the original, more scientific study, and part of that included evolution of halakha, you know, which, you know, the point that I made earlier, and exactly along those lines that they were trying to recover, if, you know, for centuries, Judaism adapted to its environment, by us doing the same, just differently, we're still following this tradition that happened for generations before.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's,
And we have that kind of, with the Constitution and then the amendments, because amendments were made as a
right.
climate change.
You know, sometimes I think of what would have happened if, remember that old movie they used to show on the airplanes all the time, Red Dawn, where the U.S. was invaded by a communist Mexico or something like that, and overrun, and you know, I try and think, okay, what if the commies had won, and we were exiled, and we took with us the entire civil code, and mm-hmm. said, here it is, we will observe it, we can never change it because we no longer have a Congress or a Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to live with these laws that were made up 200, 300, 400 years ago, you know, like every once in a while you see these things in the newspaper, laws that are still on the books, like every mm-hmm. automobile has to be preceded by a guy with a flag.
Yeah, can't spit on the sidewalk, all that great stuff. Jaywalking, I like that one.
So the question is, you've got these competing claims of mm-hmm. being the heir. At what point does it totally split off into a mm-hmm. different species?
Well,
so I'm interested in what happens with the Hasidim.
Well, we're going to get there later on. The reason why I introduce this, you can see from the model that Rambam sets up here, how easily it could be applied to today, and how much is going to depend on which side you fall on, and what your perspective is, which is, again, why I call the series The Politics of Exclusion. Because, you know, if you view things from different perspectives, well, are they doing something that different? If so, what, and if not, how? Do you really set up a break? Do you not set up a break? And all that, you know, stuff which, you know, we'll get to responsa that deal with that, you know, eventually. You know, I promise eventually we're going to get to certain responsa and see, well, how did these deviations make? But these are exactly the exact same questions that we're going to ask. And what are the parts, even if you just are going to rely on this Rambam, what are the ones you're going to focus on? Are you going to focus on results? Are you going to focus on what's going on in their heads? Are you going to focus on what their stated ideology versus the ideology that you think that they're doing, etc.? It gets really complicated. Yeah.
And I think there's a complication of doing this and then, let's say, applying it to government, because let's say, you know, there's certain laws, you know, Shabbos laws that someone follows, but we've discussed before that perhaps someone may not choose to follow it, but if he keeps quiet about it and doesn't flaunt in everyone's face and make some declaratory statement that I'm not following this, where it causes all kinds of trouble, you know, people look the other way, or you mm-hmm. bring up certain issues. But with government, suppose the government suddenly decides to vote on some other tax. We're all subject to that, whether we like it or not, and we're stuck. And then if we don't, let's say, pay that tax, we could have criminal... So, you know what I'm saying? There's...
The analogy to civil government, you know, stops at a certain point. I'm fully aware of that. Yeah. I mean, we don't live under, you know, a rabbinical court today. Yeah. You know, we don't have the same sort of authority, but there's certain theoretical analogies that do still fit in, which is why I make the ones that I do. Yeah. Can't save a lot of trouble.
And I'm saying also, like, we perhaps, as an individual, might have the leeway, even if it's wrong, to not do something within the community in a religious sense that we don't have in the government sense. Mm-hmm. Because it's imposed on us. And I think a lot of people feel, whether it's a Republican Party or a Democratic Party, most of these people don't even represent us to begin with, no matter what party it is.
You also, you know, recognize, I mean, you'll raise an interesting point, throw in, like, one final question here that, you know, again, I'm not going to answer this, but I'll throw out an idea to think about, is an idea of civil disobedience. Right? Okay. Civil disobedience is you're breaking a law because you think this law is immoral, or you are breaking a law because you think something is immoral. You're not actually causing damage to other people. You might block traffic. You know, people who will protest and block traffic, you know, get arrested. Sometimes people get arrested intentionally because you get arrested, you make the news, you know, power to your cause. And you have people who say, you know, I'm not going to do this in Judaism because I think it's morally wrong. And think about that for a second, and maybe, you know, if there would be a difference between civil disobedience.
Give us an example.
Women of the Wall.
All right. Well, Women of the Wall is a little bit, that's a little bit more complicated, because with that, you're not so much dealing with halacha, meaning there's no halacha against the woman carrying the Sefer Torah at all. But you are dealing there with civil Israeli law, and there you have a mixture of religious and civil law at the same time. And there you've got a really blurred line. So, I mean, because there you could say, yes, it's an act, it's a religious statement, but it's also civil disobedience. My understanding is that civil law is, you know, the kotel, and what goes on at the kotel is under the auspices of a certain rabbinic body. And if the rabbinic body says no, then violating it isn't violating halacha as much as violating civil law, which is why they'd be subject to arrest. Meaning it's not that we're arresting you because you're not keeping halacha, we're arresting you because you're not keeping civil law. So that would be more of the civil disobedience as opposed to going against Jewish law. That's why, you know, Israel stuff is even murkier, because then, you know, the lines do get blurred. Yeah, question, thoughts, and, you know, go around and see if anyone else has stuff to say. And
the Yeshivish crowd invented the black hat. Mm. Separate themselves from everybody else. And you look at any other Jews, if you were a kippah, as not really authentic, because we're keeping the, like, Polish shtievels, and we're resurrecting all those great yeshivas, and you guys are just outside.
Mm-hmm. So what some of them would say is, you know, my tradition, and, you know, I have a tradition that I got from my father, it's very different than their tradition. They can say, well, you're not following, and then we'll use terms like the Mesorah, you know, with the definitive argument, as opposed to a Mesorah. It's the Mesorah, to the exclusion, literally, of everything else, right? So you'll find that on the more extreme, you know, not obviously more extreme, but certainly on writer sides, too. Say, well, unless you follow these rabbis, you come to the same conclusions, you're not part of our group, you're not following our tradition, and you could be as dismissed just as easily as conservative and reform, even if, you know, you might keep more mitzvot ritually and socially than even they would on the right. Any other thoughts, Rand?
Been quiet. The hat becomes like a machitza between.
That's more of a social identification thing. That's, you know, could very well be.
It's a separation.
Any other thoughts? No, that's all. Thank you very much. We'll continue next week. Some more interesting stuff where we get into a lot more of the social dynamics involved here. Okay. All right, so have a wonderful week.